uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yep, can you hear me? Well, it's been a very, very busy week, but there's another issue out there that you may be aware of, and that is discussion is hot and heavy about the Chinese government trying to buy Unocal, a major oil company in the United States of America. And that is, needless to say, a great issue of concern to many of us, in terms of our economy, in terms of the growing power of China over our economy, and the potential loss of jobs. It is. Right, and as you know, they bought a section of IBM not so long ago. As I read somewhere, they're looking at Maytag now as well. So we're having the absurd situation of China increasingly exerting power over the United States of America and our jobs. And you're right, this relates very much to the disastrous trade agreement that we have with China, which is now about $160 billion. And it relates to the fact that we are losing millions of good-paying jobs just in the paper today, yesterday. IBM, while cutting back on jobs in the United States, is growing jobs in India substantially. So this whole issue touches not only on blue-collar jobs, it touches on white-collar information technology jobs. A few months ago, General Motors announced they were laying off 25,000 American workers. The automobile industry in China is booming. There is now every reason to believe, unless we deal with this issue, that cars made for sale in the United States, to be sold in the United States, will be manufactured in China, which really means a severe, severe blow to the entire automobile industry. Parts are already being made, billions of dollars in parts will be made in China. And all of this, Tom, to my mind, contributes to the decline of the middle class, to the reason that the vast majority of workers are seeing a decline in their real wages, why poverty is increasing. It's an issue that we have got to get a handle on, and unfortunately, Mr. Bush and the White House are sticking with the large multinational corporations who make out like bandits under these provisions, but are ignoring the needs of American workers.
Board operator in Portland, Oregon, that I'm hearing from the folks in the chat room and also here on the radio station at WTKG. People can hear Bernie on the air just fine. They can't hear me. So you need to put me into whichever program mode is going to get me mixed through the board into the output stream. Oh, you can hear it now? Okay, great. We got it working. Okay. Bernie, also, there have been a number of interesting votes over the last couple of days that have had to do with a variety of things from the Patriot Act to the flag burning amendment. These guys are going to pull this old canard out?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Patriot Act, as you know, we won a major victory last week. And I think that sends a message to the Bush administration that not only Democrats are an independent in my case, but a growing number of Republicans, and we had 38 Republicans on board this amendment, are saying, of course we're going to do everything we can to protect the American people against any terrorist attacks, and that's basic. But we have to do it in a way that conforms to the Constitution of the United States and that protects our basic rights. And I think there is growing momentum for that. Tom, many of your listeners may not know that there are seven states in the United States, including my state of Vermont, that have gone on record in expressing concerns about the Patriot Act. There are over 270 communities that have gone on record expressing concerns about the Patriot Act. Librarians, booksellers, many, many people from all kinds of political perspectives are saying, wait a second, we are worried about privacy rights. We are worried about the government having too much power to spy on our lives. And this, you know, it deals with the Patriot Act. It goes beyond the Patriot Act. It goes with all kinds of technology that's out there where people are really worried that their medical records are going to end up in their employer's files, or when they try to get a job, somebody's going to know that they have a particular illness. That we really, our privacy rights are under assault. And I think there is a backlash now in the United States that says enough is enough about that issue.
Yeah, well said. Bernie, one of the charges that has been leveled against the whole private contractors in Iraq thing, we have the second largest army in Iraq right now, is not Great Britain. It's the American private contractors.
Right.
And one of the charges that has been leveled is that they are doing the things that it would be a crime, I mean literally a crime, if American soldiers did, in many cases. And now we see also that the military, the Defense Department, has outsourced to private marketing firms the collection, aggregation of data on potential draftees. This may be, you know, either for draft or for recruiting purposes. They're going way beyond just, you know, the person's name and address. They're getting social security numbers. They're trying to track down, I mean, the credit histories, where they shop, what their preferences are, their ethnicity, all this kind of information.
But much this is exactly of which, what I'm talking about.
This
is an invasion of our privacy, of our kids' privacy. In this case, it's the Defense Department. Whether it's, you know, thinking about, I don't know that it's thinking about the draft right now, but at the very least, we know that there are serious recruiting problems, so they want to have information so they can better able target potential recruits. This is not a good thing, very, very clearly.
Yeah.
And it's something I would say, and I wish I had, you know, we're just beginning to get into this. This whole privacy issue, Tom, is just a huge issue. And again, it's not just the Patriot Act. Although the Patriot Act is maybe the most forceful government, Bush administration expression of that. It is all of this technology. You read in the papers last week that some company lost information on millions of credit cards. Who's going to get that? Who stole that? What does it mean to any of us? Identity theft, all of this stuff. There's an explosion of technology out there that makes all of us very, very vulnerable, that all aspects of our lives are going to be in somebody else's file, and we should be concerned about that.
Now, under this Real ID Act, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Bernie, under the Real ID Act that recently got, you know, attached to a spending bill and I believe passed and signed, this is going to require over the next few years for biometric data to be put on driver's licenses in a way that could include RFID chips. RFID chips are these little chips that you can read with a scanner from 100 feet or 100 yards away, so that if a bunch of people got together to protest a government action, or, you know, you could just drive by with a scanner and instantly know who, not just who those people are, but their social security numbers, their blood type, their iris scan. And in the commercial venue, as somebody walks into a store, we could have the world, you know, where you've got an interactive display that says, well, hello, Mr. Sanders, good to see you. How's your wife? You know, and they know everything about you instantly.
That's what I'm talking about. I apologize for not being able to give you an explicit answer now as to whether that all of that is in this ID thing. But that is the potential that we worry about very, very much, that any place you go, any shop that you're in, that there is somebody who will be able to be following you 24 hours a day and have all kinds of information about you. And we cannot take that lying down. We can't, you know, every day there's another invasion of our privacy, and we just got to fight back and say enough is enough. We need protections.
So how do we do that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it ain't so easy. But, I mean, that's just, we're going to have to be very systematic about doing that. Certainly by opposing the onerous provisions of the USA Patriot Act is one area. I've been involved in fighting against the provision that essentially allows the Justice Department and the FBI to walk into a library without any probable cause, without any particular reason to believe that somebody is involved in terrorism, and get their the books that they have taken out or the books that they have purchased from a bookstore. There are other provisions in the Patriot Act that are equally onerous, but that's the provision, the amendment that we passed would prohibit the FBI from monitoring the reading habits in libraries and bookstores. So I think what the good news here is you're beginning to see a response from the American people and from Congress about the invasions of our privacy and the understanding the government is going too far. The private sector is going too far. The American people, a free society, do not have to, should not have every private aspect of our lives in somebody else's hands.
Yeah. Bernie, I'm broadcasting live from Grand Rapids, Michigan right now, and Michigan has one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. GM has just announced they're going to lay off 25,000 people or just do away with their jobs altogether. The Chinese are talking about buying Maytag. I'm not sure to what extent Maytag is here in Michigan, but we have other companies, Electrolux and others, who are being shut down here, the jobs exported. This is happening all across the United States. It's particularly hard hitting the manufacturing sector. In the Wall Street Journal about the Chinese attempt to buy Unocal the other day, there was this one comment where they said the Chinese are looking for any manufacturing business in America that they can buy. Is Congress going to take any kind of action to stop this?
I could tell you, I mean, on that issue. The answer is, obviously, many of us understand that if we lose our manufacturing base, if we lose our good-paying jobs, the middle class is just going to disappear. So some of us are vigorously fighting against these disastrous trade agreements, which enable the multinational corporations to say, bye-bye, the United States of America. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for working with us. We're over in China right now. We're fighting it vigorously. The good news, if you like, is there is more and more opposition to current trade agreements. The CAFTA agreement, Central America Free Trade Agreement, which may or may not come up as early as next week or after the July 4th break, is in serious trouble. But having said that, the Bush administration and corporate America have huge amounts of money and campaign contributions to spend. They have been successful in the past in terms of NAFTA, in terms of permanent normal trade relations with China. But to answer your question, Tom, is there the sufficient degree of alarm about the decline of good-paying jobs in the United States in Congress? The answer is certainly not. And in the White House, of course, they are sympathetic to the multinationals who are moving. They think outsourcing, frankly, is a good thing. That's what they've said in the past.
Yeah. And in fact, we've had officials of the Bush administration on record saying outsourcing.
Absolutely. They have said in so many words that if a product can be produced in another country for lower prices, it is a good thing. So American workers, if you can work for lower than 30 cents an hour, hey, you can keep your job. But
you can compete.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, incredible. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. We're going to invite folks from the audience here in Grand Rapids to come in and ask questions. Also, if you'd like to call, 866-889-8894. Our telephone number, it's 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle. You razzle dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it, made them believe you were compassionate.
Oh, and they believed
gave
it too.
The old hocus pocus, you misdirected them. With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, you played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them. Let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes, just so long as I'm the dictator. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie Sanders had to go take a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives. So he ran off. He will be back shortly, hopefully. In all probability, generally these votes do not take long. They only hold them open for 15 minutes, except for, of course, the Medicare vote, which they held open for 3 hours, first time in 200 years since the founding of the country. Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert running around and messing with things. Joe is with us here in the studio in Grand Rapids. We can, you know, when Congressman Sanders comes back, we can toss this to him again. But something on your mind?
Yeah, they worried about burning the flag, but I'm more worried about burning the Constitution of the United States. These people have been taken apart ever since they got in office.
How so?
Well, they've taken away, like the other day, we talked about the eminent domain. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking about our rights, you know, and public, you know, like the libraries, you know, we don't have no privacy no more.
Yeah.
All your data is being sent to India for processing, you know, whether it's medical or taxes or whatever. And my biggest concern here is I've always been a Michigan resident, and watching Michigan just kind of dry up here with all of the jobs leaving.
Yeah.
I remember years ago when Gerald R. Ford was in office, we lost the Detroit Tank Command. We also lost the cruise missile was manufactured in Novi, Michigan. And we've also, you know, we've been taking hits all over the place. We used to make the Jeeps. We used to make a lot of, in World War II, we were at our height. We made a lot of products for the World War II.
Yeah.
And now we're down to making very little things.
Well, we haven't had an industrial policy of the United States for 30 years. I mean, that's just the bottom line. And with regard to privacy, and you know, much to our detriment, I mean, it's a terrible thing. And as regards to privacy, the other day I wanted to check my credit report. You know, you see all these stories about, they're stealing credit card numbers left and right and all this kind. And, you know, it's legitimately a lot of people are concerned about that. And so I went to one of these credit bureau, you know, things that you can check your credit report. And first of all, of course, they wanted to be paid for it. So, you know, we lose your credit information, you can pay us to find out what we lost. Okay, so I did that. And then I discovered, as this person was asking me for my Social Security number, my mother's maiden name, the city that I was born, I mean, you know, all of this personal information, I said, where are you? And this guy, because this guy had this faintest accent, but he sounded pretty American. And he said, I'm in Bangalore, India. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to somebody in India and giving them all my private information, and what kind of control is there on that? You know, you're absolutely right, Joe. And the lack of an industrial policy in the United States, the lack of a commitment to make sure that that not only do we have good jobs, but that we're making the stuff that we need. I mean, during World War II, we were able to say, okay, immediately we're going to stop making women's stockings and start making parachutes. Remember the nylon thing? We're going to stop making car tires and we're going to start making tank tires or you know, Humvees or whatever. We're going to stop making automobiles. We're going to start making tanks and airplanes. We don't have the industrial infrastructure anymore. If we had to fight a serious war, I mean, our national security is at risk because of 25 years of insane industrial policy. They have been selling our country down the tubes, it's nice to point fingers and say, oh, it's mostly the Republicans. It's not. The Democrats have been in this, too. It's I'd say it's mostly the Republicans, frankly, but my bias, well, no, there are a lot of Democrats who are standing up against this. I don't know of any Republicans, with the exception, single exception of Ron Paul in Texas, who are standing up against this. And so I think ultimately we've got to deal with this at the political level and talk to our elected officials. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
With you, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Congressman Bernie Sanders, America's congressman. His website, bernie.org, by the way, the only independent member of the United States House of Representatives, not a Democrat, not a Republican, a man who, in my opinion, I know I'm not, this isn't Bernie's rhetoric, this is mine, a man who stands up for America. Congressman Sanders, welcome back. You had a floor vote?
I'm down here on the in the floor right now.
Yeah, okay. And are we going to be able to hold on to you for the hour?
Yep, I may have to zip out for a few seconds every once in a while. I've got 7 votes, actually.
Okay. All right. So I'm sorry I can't talk to you on the breaks because I'm doing this remote from Michigan and you're in Washington and it's all being mixed in Portland, Oregon. So, and then sent up to a satellite out of Denver, Colorado, where it then comes down all over the United States. It's amazing.
Truly national broadcast here, right?
It truly is. It absolutely is. Okay, we've got some calls here. 1-866-889-8894. And also, any of the folks here at the Celebration Cinema who want to come in and ask a question, we've got some folks lined up here also here in Grand Rapids to ask you questions, Bernie. But first, a call from Baltimore, Maryland. This is Kenny on the line. Hey, Kenny.
How you doing, Tom? How you doing, Bernie?
Good. How are you?
I'm still trying to cool down. Let me just make two quick comments. I'm trying to cool down for Carl's statement that he made. My wife has been in the military for 6 years. She's a Democrat. I'm an independent, and we were totally outraged by that. I think Bush's political capital just went into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And as for the Social Security, with the argument I wanted to make, I don't think there's anything wrong with Social Security. I think every time you lose a job over here, Social Security loses a job. I think the real problem is our jobs is going away, and I don't care what fix they put on Social Security. If you keep losing jobs, it will never be enough.
Well, Ken, you make a lot of good points. Karl Rove, I think, to know what Rove said the other day is I think that liberals or Democrats or whatever are kind of soft on terrorism. They think that terrorists should go into therapy and we shouldn't fight terrorism. Obviously, that's rhetorical nonsense, and it's demagoguery. Everybody in this country is concerned about terrorism, and everybody wants to do all that we can to protect the American people from another terrorist attack. And it is an outrage that Rove would make that statement. And in terms of Social Security, I think Ken hits it right on the head. The two major studies on Social Security show that Social Security will be able to pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American from between 36 years, which is what the Social Security Administration says, to 47 years, which is what the Congressional Budget Office says. And some people think that those...
That's right now, if nothing is done.
If nothing is done. And if you make modest changes, such as lifting the cap, which is now at $90,000, and say to wealthy people that they have to pay 365 days a year, like everybody else, or most of the people have to do, the problem is completely solved. Ken is right. There are no very serious problems with regard to Social Security. Unfortunately, Bush wants to move in the direction of privatization. His friends on Wall Street like that idea. There was just a hearing the other day with a bunch of banks who stand to make a killing if Social Security is privatized and everybody has to have their accounts on Wall Street. So we got to fight very hard. And by the way, I think we're winning that fight. I think the American people are catching on at a time when we're seeing pensions going down the toilet bowl. People who are promised their pensions, losing their pensions. People understand that for the last 70 years, Social Security has paid out every nickel owed to every eligible American, and we're not going to give up on that.
There you go. Brian in Grand Rapids, sitting here in the studio with us, Celebration Studios. Hey, Brian.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about the war and the draft.
Yep.
We've all heard the recent opinion polls that say that something like 52% of Americans now believe that the war was not worth it. My personal experience has been that it's much higher, much closer to 90% of the people that I speak with believe that this invasion / occupation is a ruse and that our soldiers are dying needlessly. My question is, if the United States military is already overextended in Iraq, and it appears that we are, and recruitment is at an all-time low, how can we possibly be prepared to defend ourselves against a real threat such as North Korea, with the opinion without reinstating a full-scale military draft? I'm not talking about the economic draft that's already going on in this country. And second of all, is it not true that the American people probably would not be in favor of a draft unless, God forbid, we're hit again like we were on 9/11? You know, they're telling us
right
on the right that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and which, in my opinion, this administration has left us wide open for because of the war in Iraq, because of the fact that he hasn't captured Osama bin Laden, and because of his policies with North Korea.
You raised a lot of issues, Brian. And the most important point that you're making, and I think many military people would agree with you, is that this war has caused havoc for the United States military. We are grossly overextended. Recruitment is down. A substantial number of people in Iraq today are National Guards, people who never thought that they would be there. Some of them are 45, 50 years old who never in a million years thought that they would end up in the middle of a hot war. And you're right. You're right about worrying about how capable we will be in defending this country, given what this war has done to our military. My own view, let me just say a couple of words on the war. I think the time is long overdue for the President of the United States to give us an exit strategy. I think we have got to have a plan to start bringing our troops home. I don't think we can do it tomorrow, but we've got to begin doing it. And that's a demand that a number of us in Congress are making on the President. Now, in terms of the draft, my gut feeling is, and I may be wrong on this, I don't think that the President would institute a draft. And you know why? I think it's for political reasons. If you institute a draft, suddenly the entire middle class of this country is dragged into foreign policy, is dragged into the war in Iraq. And I think there are a lot of middle class families who are saying, wait a second, you know, I want my kid to go to college. I don't want my kid to go into this war and get killed. And then it would lead to even far more opposition. And you're right, Ken, in saying the sentiment certainly is growing against the war in Iraq. If you instituted a draft, I think that sentiment would spike all the way up, and I doubt that the President would do that.
Thank you, Brian. Steve in Grand Rapids is with us live in the studio. Steve?
Yes, I am here to ask about something you might or might not have heard about. It's called the Business Software Alliance, or the BSA. This was actually founded on a grant from Bill Gates. It is an organization that will make SWAT team-type raids on small businesses with the backing of the United States Marshals Service, just to make sure that all the software the businesses use are, quote-unquote, legitimately purchased. And this is an instance of copyright law.
Is there a piece of legislation associated with this, Steve?
A lot of it has to do with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was passed in 1997.
Okay. So your question for Bernie?
It is, what are you doing about the threats that copyright laws are posing to both the First and the Fourth Amendments?
Good question. Thank you, Steve.
Steve, I got to tell you that I am not familiar with what you're talking about and SWAT team raids. We are obviously very concerned about privacy issues, about the overreaching of the federal government in our personal lives, which is why I introduced and got passed just last week a provision limiting the FBI in terms of the USA Patriot Act. So we are working on that issue. We're very concerned about it. And I think one of the serious concerns that the American people have, regardless of their political perspectives, a lot of conservatives are very concerned about is privacy rights and the overreaching of the federal government in terms of our personal liberties.
Well said. Also in the studio, we have Linda. Linda here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Linda, welcome to the program, and you're on live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Thank you very much. I just for the record, I want to say this is the first time I've ever dared to be on live radio, so this is a little nerve-wracking.
Wonderful having you here.
Thank you. I am very concerned. I understand that Congress is attempting to reduce the funds for public television by 45%, which would grossly impair their ability to function. And I'm wondering, Senator, in your opinion, what factors are leading to this kind of assault on PBS? And what can the public do to make it clear we have to have more objective sources of news and educational programming?
Well, Linda, if that's your first question on national radio, you've just done very, very well.
Thank you very much. Come back again. Thank you so much.
Linda, the Republican leadership wanted to cut funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting from $400 million down to $300 million, a 25% cut. But in addition to that, there were other cuts. What I'm happy to tell you is that yesterday, by a very wide margin, the House of Representatives voted no to that proposal. You had a number of Republicans joining, I think probably almost every Democrat, and myself, an independent, in saying just what you said, that at a time when there is more and more cynicism with regard to media, more and more concern about corporate control over everything that we see, hear, and read, that public television, public radio has the respect of the American people for doing an objective job. They do a very good job in children's programming and so forth and so on. So the good news is that we were able to defeat that Republican leadership effort to cut funding for public broadcasting. On the other hand, what I am very concerned about is literally just yesterday as well, the same day that we defeated the attempt to cut funding, the Bush administration has appointed a former co-chairperson of the Republican Party to be the president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and there is a real concern that they are going to politicize public television, public radio, and try to inject right-wing programming into a network that has historically been separate from politics and should remain separate from politics. So there's good news and bad news in terms of public television.
Okay, we've got an entire phone bank full of callers, plus we've got a whole bunch of people here in Grand Rapids to talk to you, Bernie. So moving right along, Dave in Scranton, Pennsylvania, first on the line. Hey, Dave, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Congressman, quick question. We seem to have an adolescent running the country. He's intent on provoking other countries. He seems to be intent on provoking the citizens within this country. How close are we to having another Kent State, another radical civil disobedience in this country?
Well, I don't know that, Dave, and let's hope to God that never happens. What I do know and what really upsets me very much, you will recall, Dave, that Bush, when he campaigned the first time in 2000, he said, "I am a uniter, not a divider." Do you remember that? That was his language, and yet there has been no president that I can remember who has done more to divide the American people on every issue, who has not sought a middle ground, who has not tried to compromise. When he appoints justices to our federal courts, he goes to the extreme right wing. He tolerates bigotry in terms of people demagoguing on the religious issue, calling members of Congress anti-Christian or whatever, has put forth the Patriot Act, gives tax breaks to billionaires, and cuts programming for low and moderate income people. So in every instance, he is dividing up this country to a very frightening degree. But let's hope that it never again we see a Kent State.
Okay. Steve is with us here in the studio in Grand Rapids at WTKG at Celebration Cinemas. Steve?
Yeah, it's my understanding on September 24th that an impeachment rally is going to be held in Washington, D.C. Given the facts of the Downing Street memo of fixing the intelligence to accommodate Bush's immoral war, what is the possibility of impeachment proceedings now or after the 2006 election?
Well, I am not in favor of impeachment proceedings because it makes no sense to me to see Dick Cheney become the president of the United States. I think what we have got to do, those of us who are concerned about the war, concerned about the decline of the middle class, the disastrous environmental policies of the Bush administration, we got to do it, in my view, others may disagree with me, the old-fashioned way, and that is political organization, rally people so that in 2006 the Republicans lose control over the House and the Senate, and in 2008 we elect a progressive to the presidency. So that's the area that I am focusing on.
Great. Okay. Michael in Grand Rapids is with us. Hey, Michael.
Hello.
Your question for Congressman Sanders.
Sanders, I need your advice. I haven't seen any electric cars in the Ford or the Chevy showrooms or anywhere around here. And I have seen some on the Internet that Chinese are making, and I think they're considering also making some integrated photovoltaics or wind generators or even an exercise machine to charge up the car's batteries. I'm in a bind. I'm going to have to outsource this, getting this item that I need because our companies are
Michael,
not,
we're down to about 2.5 minutes. What's your question?
Making the products that I want. I don't know if I just speak for myself or how many people I speak for. What would you suggest I do?
Well, Michael, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is incredible, Michael, that we are driving vehicles today that get worse mileage per gallon than used to be the case. With all of the technology out there, we are going in exactly the wrong direction, which is one of the reasons that the American automobile manufacturers are losing ground to the Japanese. I think the American people want fuel efficiency. They want hybrids. They want to see development of electric cars that can certainly be used for people who are, you know, living 50 miles away from where they work. And we have certainly not moved forward vigorously in that area. There is huge opportunities from an economic point of view, from an energy point of view. We can save huge amounts of energy, protect our environment if we do that. So that's an area that we are not doing well, and we need to radically transform what we do.
Okay, we're down to about a minute.
I'm going to have to take a break for about 30 seconds and cast a vote here, okay?
Okay, fine.
Hang on one second.
We'll hang on for you. And in the meantime, Jim in Holland, Michigan is on the line. Hey, Jim, Congressman Sanders has had to go take a vote, but you have the mic.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Welcome to West Michigan.
Thank you.
I think this is a great opportunity to rehash the things that happened over at Calvin College for their commencement. I don't know if you got a whole lot of this information because it wasn't carried on national wire.
Great. Well,
a lot.
We have about a minute left, so why don't you just wrap it up for our listeners?
Well, there was when President Bush gave the commencement address at Calvin College, there was a rather large protest that many of the faculty and students at Calvin College said that the president's views were not in line with the teachings of the college, specifically with his neglecting the needy to coddle the rich, desecrating the environment, and misleading the country into war. A lot of us in Western Michigan do not see those as Christian values.
Good point.
Not following Matthew 25, as they say.
Well,
yeah. Okay. Bernie, you're back.
I'm
great.
Back.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim. Bernie, I'll let you wrap that up. We got about 10 seconds.
Well, Jim raises a very good question. Issue of values. And values, to me, means reaching out to the poor, reaching out to the hungry, and certainly this administration is not doing that.
Great. Well said, Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, it's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we're back, 55 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We're broadcasting live from the Celebration Cinemas, the WTKG studio in the Celebration Cinemas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Brian is with us in the studio with a question for Congressman Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is where you can find out more about Bernie on the Internet, by the way. And Brian, go ahead.
Congressman Sanders, I want to first wish you luck on your upcoming Senate bid.
Thank you very much. I hope that someday
Tom can be introducing you as the first independent president of the United States. But I'd like to get your take on the yesterday's Supreme Court decision, because it seems like just pure corporatism to me to allow cities and states to take away property strictly for business purposes.
I tend to agree with you. I haven't studied the whole decision, but at first blush, I think you're exactly right. We're using the powers of the city and state for corporate profits, and obviously that's not right.
Yeah, this boggled my mind, Bernie. I went on the air immediately and said, I think that this is a wrong decision. And I said, I predict that all the right-wingers are going to be on the air saying, see, it's those liberals, I told you so, that kind of thing. And I'm saying, as a liberal, I disagree, or progressive, or whatever you want to call me, I think that this was a wrong decision. And somebody called up and said, sure enough, right at this minute, Neil Bortz is saying, it's those liberals, and Limbaugh is saying, it's those it just seems like...
But it's those liberals on the Supreme Court?
Yeah. Well, the folks who voted against... Yeah, exactly. I mean, of the five people who voted for it, three of them were nominated by Republican presidents,
right.
Only two by Democratic presidents. But nonetheless, the guys on the right called them the liberals. But Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, and Sandra Day O'Connor were the ones who voted against it. And I agreed with O'Connor's dissent. Thank you very much for that, Brian. Good one.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the telephones, 1-866-889-8894. Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Yes. Senator Bernie.
Congressman.
I think that they
Congressman
are,
Bernie.
Congressman.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think that saving our country from total disaster comes down to one thing, getting rid of their crooked voting machines. As long as they have them, it doesn't matter how we vote. Can we do anything about this?
Thank
well,
you.
Alice, that's a very important question that Tom has a lot. And the answer is we are doing our best to make sure that there are paper trails associated with every touchscreen ballot in America. People must have absolute certainty that when they cast the vote, it is accurately counted. So this is an issue we're working on very, very hard.
And this is the piece of legislation that you've co-sponsored along with Rush Holt.
That's correct.
Congressman Rush Holt. And in the Senate, it is Hillary Clinton put it forward, did she not?
I believe that is true.
Yeah. So people can contact their elected representatives and speak out about that. Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us,
Good
Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Bernie.org, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we get our talking points from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Celebration Cinema in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A special affection for this place. I'm giving a speech on Saturday in a church I used to be a member of. We're going to a wedding on Saturday afternoon. My nephew's getting married. My family's from here. I grew up here. I was born here. It's great to be back. And of course, we've been on WTKG here for a couple of years and a marvelous radio station. My cousin Jane is in the audience, and John and Amanda. Great to see you all. And so anyhow, it's great to be back here. And along with us, we have Bob Potter. Bob Potter is the president of the Local 951 of the UFCW Union, one of the more fast-growing and vibrant unions in the United States, Bob. And also, you're the international vice president of the union as well.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon.
Glad to have you here. And by the way, if anybody has any questions for Bob or questions about labor in general, I'd say Bob could probably answer them. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. Bob, you were talking about a coalition of five unions. For the folks who are not labor insiders, for the people who don't know what's really going on in the labor movement, which is probably most of our listening audience, you know, what's the story here? What's happening with this?
Five international unions announced last week that they had formed a coalition to move forward on a workers' agenda. Those five unions are the UFCW, the Teamsters, HERE Unite, if I hadn't mentioned the laborers, they were part of it, and SEIU, the Service Employees Union.
Right. Would it be accurate to say that SEIU and UFCW are probably the two most vital unions at this moment in terms of, you know, really moving forward? Not to slam any other unions, but it seems like you guys are constantly in the news, the two of you, between your organizing efforts, with the big box stores and so on, between the two of you.
Well, I'd echo that all five members of the coalition really are in that kind of progressive mode, where they've seen dramatic growth, including the laborers and as well as the Teamsters.
Right. Now, does this mean that there's a schism in the labor movement between a progressive bunch of unions or a progressive faction or wing of unions and a wing of unions that, well, how would you characterize them? Kind of the old guard, or, I mean, I don't want to be derogatory, but you know, if there's a, I'm not sure what labels apply within the industry.
Well, I certainly would not put any pejorative terms on any of the other unions that are not part of the coalition. Quite frankly, I think the five unions put the coalition together to move forward an agenda, not in reaction to anything negative about the AFL-CIO directly. But clearly the intent is to move forward. And the thought was that those five unions, the leadership of those unions as well as the members of those unions, are positioned in a way that they can move forward on an agenda, especially for people, workers in the service industry. They're best suited to do it, and we have, as a coalition, a plan and an agenda to move forward. And we think we can most effectively do that by acting jointly, and that's the real focus of it. It's not a schism. It clearly is a coalition formed to move forward the labor movement in this country.
We had Marty Fishgold on the other day, who is the president of the ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, which is, well, at one time was viewed as sort of an offshoot of the AFL-CIO, but now is increasingly independent. And he was talking about that labor needs a new media strategy, and it needs a major and significant media strategy. And they're going to be having their convention in July. In fact, I'll be there and speaking about, you know, media and how to do media and things. Do you see reaching out to the media or through the media, reaching out to the average Americans who are not members of unions? I mean, given the unfortunate success that Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and you know, even to some extent under the Clinton administration, it continued. I mean, it didn't get rolled back substantially. And now under the Bush administration, there's a war on labor that Ronald Reagan declared. Do you see reaching out beyond labor as part of the strategy?
Clearly, labor has been put in a box, and some of it based on our own actions. So we've kind of put ourselves in a box as well. We need to get outside that box. And part of that has to be an effective strategy to make sure that the general public knows what we're really trying to do. And the only way we're going to accomplish that is to have a good relationship with media, We have to be very assertive. We have to make sure that we do outreach to the media directly.
And what is it you're trying to do?
Organize workers, first of all. Assist workers in organizing. Because clearly the five unions that we talked about, but in addition to that, several of the other AFL unions are positioned very well to assist workers to organize. Every poll that we do of workers indicates that the majority of workers in this country, whether they belong to a union or not, want the benefits of collective bargaining. They want to organize.
They want democracy in the workplace,
they absolutely
which is what
do.
A union is.
They absolutely do.
And if that's the case, Bob, we're talking with Bob Potter, the president of the UFCW Local 951, and the international vice president of the UFCW. If that's the case, then why aren't there more unions and more organizations? Why is Walmart not unionized? If the vast majority of American workers want the benefits of collective bargaining, would like to have democracy in the workplace, would like to be represented, why isn't it happening?
There are untold number of obstacles that confront organized labor in their efforts to organize and assist workers in organizing. Some of those obstacles are based in the law itself, in terms of how difficult it is for us as unions to get access to workers. Some of it is based in terms of strategy. We need a more effective strategy given what the economy in this country looks like. We can't rely on traditional means to organize workers any longer. We need to do a very broad-based approach by community, by industry. So part of it, we have to overcome obstacles ourselves. But we are confronted with an environment where the rights of employers and the law itself curtails workplace democracy.
And yet you have an administration that's aggressively working against this. We have the Labor Department, which was set up, as I recall, in, 37 under Roosevelt following the Wagner Act of 35. The U.S. Department of Labor was set up to make sure that labor laws were being enforced and to advocate for labor so that there would be within the cabinet, within the White House, there would be somebody there who was looking out for the interests of labor and making sure that the needs of labor were met. And I want to say since Reagan, I mean, it was pretty egregious under the Reagan administration, although we need not go back that far. I mean, here we have Elaine Chao now, the Secretary of Labor in the Bush administration, openly hostile to labor. What has happened at the federal level, and what can people do to say, you know, it's like the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't protect the environment anymore. The Labor Department doesn't protect labor anymore. It's like we've fallen through the rabbit hole. Up is down, left is right. Things have been turned inside out. What can people do about this?
Well, I think the first place to start is to educate workers, and everyone has a role in that. Every worker has an obligation to assist in making sure that the people they work with understand that the federal government doesn't speak for workers. The Department of Labor doesn't speak for workers. Their agenda, their objectives are clearly different than representing workers. But there's a common misconception from many workers that somehow the National Labor Relations Board or the Department of Labor is really there to advance their interests, and that clearly is not the case. What we really find, especially focused from the National Labor Relations Board in their approach to organizing, is basically to interpret the law in such a way that it makes it more difficult for workers to exercise their rights. The same thing is true in terms of the Department of Labor. Their objectives are to make it more difficult for unions to operate effectively. So whatever they can do, and certainly has been true over the last 2 years, whatever they can do to ensure the fact that unions have more reporting requirements, more difficulty in proceeding with the kind of objectives that they have in the workplace, the Department of Labor basically curtails unions. It doesn't assist them, and it certainly doesn't assist workers.
Is there any kind of legal action that can be taken? I mean, is this against the law, what Elaine Chao and the Labor Department are doing?
Some of it, I guess, should be determined whether it's in effect actually against the law. We're certainly proponents for labor unions, workers, to think about what kinds of actions they can take. And some of that may well be to take some of these issues forward to litigate over them. Because clearly we think some of the most recent interpretations, especially when it comes down to financial reporting, are really different than what the law in effect says. And we have an obligation, I think, as organizations, as workers, to litigate against those interpretations.
Yeah, I think, again, for those folks who aren't labor wonks, let's just make it clear, when you're talking about the financial reporting, basically the Bush administration is doing now to organize labor what the Nixon administration did to people on Nixon's enemy list with the IRS. You know, they went in, Nixon ordered IRS audits of people that he didn't like, any reporter who reported anything bad about him, and people found themselves having to spend fortunes to deal with these very, very intrusive IRS audits. And the labor movement right now is facing something very similar to that, both in terms of actual responses from the Labor Department and in proposed legislation and rules changes that would make things much more difficult. Do you want to give us the 30-second synopsis on that?
Well, I'll give you a case in point just in the context of what those requirements are like for a union officer. One of the new interpretations in terms of how we report expenditures includes how union officers account for their time. So we've, in effect, had to do this. We've had to install completely new accounting procedures as well as new computer procedures in order to accommodate those recent interpretations. For example, I have to account for my time in 15-minute increments. So I have to allocate what my schedule is on a day-to-day basis about what type of activities I'm doing for every 15 minutes that I'm working.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, if I was applying for a job somewhere and somebody said, every 15 minutes you're going to have to write down exactly what you did in the last 15 minutes, my response would be, number one, it sounds like this company is run by some sort of weird control freak, and number two, when am I going to have the time to get my job done? I mean, is this policy by the administration trying to, is this an attempt to cripple labor?
I think you've addressed the issue very specific to what their objective is. Clearly what they want to do is make in effect it so burdensome that we can't get what we're really here for, and that is to represent workers. Clearly whatever we have to do in terms of internal procedures, we'll accommodate that, we'll work through it. But what it really does is make us less effective at a time period where we need to become more effective. And clearly that burden is placed on us by intent. The intent is clearly to curtail our activities to make sure that we're spending more time working with our accountants and our attorneys than we are working with workers.
So the war on organized labor continues at the level of the federal government by Republican administrations?
Absolutely. It's increased every month.
For how long?
At least the last 2 years, and I go back to the very beginning of the Bush administration.
How was the Clinton administration with regard to organized labor?
Less effective than we would have liked them to have been. Yeah. Clearly, we didn't see some of the onerous burdens placed on us during the Clinton administration.
So they weren't hostile, but they weren't quite the advocates that, say, Roosevelt was.
No.
Truman. No. I mean, Truman vetoed the Taft-Hartley Act, and Congress rolled it over him. We're talking with Bob Potter. He's the president of UFCW Local 951. And international vice president of that union. We'll be back. We're going to talk about health care and what your organizing plans are right after this. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 minutes past the hour, 24 and a half minutes, coming up on 25. The Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news. We're sitting here talking with Bob Potter. He's the president of UFCW Local 951 here in Grand Rapids, or in Michigan, Western Michigan, international vice president of the UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers Union. And, Bob, let's take a few phone calls here. Folks have questions about labor. If you have a question about labor or anything, really anything to do with it, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota is on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Bob. Tom knows I've called several times on this about you guys marketing and promoting the labor movement to get it back on its off its deathbed here. the Republicans have given us a silver platter by always talking about democracy is on the march, freedom is on the march, and when actually there's a war on labor, which really means a war on democracy, and why don't you guys start marketing the labor movement like democracy in the workplace? Because they have declared war on democracy in the workplace. And, I mean, this is so easy to expose their hypocrisy, and you guys aren't repeating this message in your marketing.
I think one of the questions that Tom addressed a little bit earlier was the issue about how we effectively use the media or we don't use the media. And it's certainly apparent that there are issues that we could have more effectively addressed in the past. I think your point's well taken. We have issues that market well with the American people. One of those issues is the issue of health care, because it's not just a war on workers. There's a war that's going on in this country right now to take people's benefits away. And those benefits aren't just related to simple issues about contracts. They're related to what's happening across the country on health care benefits.
Now, everybody understands all these different issues, but if you take it into the overarching theme of democracy, workers having a voice in the workplace, which is half of their waking life, and expose the hypocrisy because they use their words against them. They always talk about democracy on the march when we all know they don't like democracy. They like, you know, crony capitalism. And if you just take their words and throw it right back at them, you'll have all the, and Europe does this. Europe looks at the labor movement as citizens having democracy in a place they spend half their
life. Let me just toss this in here, Tom, because you've called and talked about this before, and a little bit of background I would share with Bob. Tom's wife is European, and he lived in Europe for a while. And they literally do not refer to unions in what country was it, Tom?
Germany.
In Germany. They literally do not refer to unions as unions. They refer to them as democracy in the workplace. And that's the phrase that everybody uses. Yeah, and what a great branding opportunity! How can we convince the American labor movement that they should start using the word, make in everybody's mind the word democracy synonymous with the word union? Thanks a lot, Tom, for the call.
A quick response would be, in effect, part of the problem is that there isn't democracy in the workplace. So what we're advocating is a series of issues about worker rights, including the right to have democracy in the workplace. And very frankly, that's a hard sell. It's, you know, I like the theme, but it certainly doesn't resonate quickly with workers, because in effect what we're saying is, look, you don't have rights in the workplace, here's the way to achieve them. It's a very difficult issue because it means in effect we're telling workers they're powerless. And they are powerless in many ways in this country. But what we need to stress to them is what they can do to change it. It isn't about a democracy that exists in the workplace. It's about a democracy that we're trying to create.
Right, and that was the point, is to say, we want democracy in the workplace. We would like to be members of this particular union as a branding way.
I think the issues that resonate with workers are more to the point of what part of their objective is simply economic.
Do you think this is too abstract?
I think it is very abstract. It clearly is true. But where we start from is what kind of economic rights they have to have. And we also have to stress the fact of what's happening to them in terms of their economic rights. We have to stress the fact that they're losing health care. And we have to talk to them about how they achieve power. And talking about how they achieve power is something that I think works more effectively than the general term of democracy.
Yeah, okay. Well, interesting. Good point. We're talking with Bob Potter. Bob Potter is the International Vice President of the UFCW, the President of the Local 951. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's a hard knock
life.
Yeah.
It's a hard knock
life. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yes. Well, that's the conservative worldview. Take us back to Charles Dickens' day.
Mr. Scrooge, may I have another lump of coal, please? It's getting cold in here.
No, you can't.
We do need our labor movement. I want my labor movement back. Welcome to the program. We have Bob Potter with us here. He's the president of the UFCW Local 951, international vice president of the union. Our number 1-866-889-8894. If you have labor questions, and Jason is on the line in Michigan. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Just real quick, it's really kind of hard to get the entire union membership to vote for their interests when they are plugged into a media that is promoting fragmenting ideas and viewpoints, and everything is broken down along those lines. And if they do not vote in their own interests, then they're voting against the interests of themselves and for, you know, their fellow workers. And it's just a matter of addressing that problem.
So,
and that's all I had to say.
Okay.
I'm also a member of the UCFW.
Oh, good. Good on you, Brian. Or Jason. Thank you. Thank you. So Bob, how do we address this? It's sort of the Tom Franks, you know, what's wrong with Kansas thing. Why do people continually vote for candidates who are openly hostile to the economic issues that are at the heart of the ability of average people to raise families, put their kids through school, have health care? Why do people vote for candidates who are out to destroy these things and just help fat cats get fatter?
Confusion and lies. Basically, and I'll try to use one very specific example. The movement that George Bush started to change Social Security is postured as if it were Social Security reform, where in reality it's a way of taking away benefits from workers who've earned those benefits. Clearly, that kind of fragmentation is by intent. There are certainly forces at work to confuse people about what the issues are, including the point of outright lying about what the impact will be. So clearly some of those issues are effective with workers. They do cause situations where workers become confused, and often when they think they are voting in their own interest, they're voting against them. So we have to make sure we get a very clear, concise message out so workers understand the issues.
One of the things that the Bushies have been particularly good at is using what they call wedge issues. Oh, look out, the gays are going to come and get you. Or, hey, look out, you know, these people, they want to burn the flag, and that's going to be the end of the America kind of thing. And they have nothing to do with labor. They have nothing to do with the average person's standard of living. But they so effectively whip up hysteria around these that they get people to essentially ignore the real issues about, you know, why is it that we're the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a national health care program? Why is it we're one of the few nations in the world that doesn't have a national industrial policy? You know, why is it that we have trade policies that only favor big multinationals and screw our workers? And it just boggles my mind that these things get through. How can labor do a better job of talking to its members and saying, hey, you guys, wake up. It's not, you know, you can have an opinion all you want about gay marriage and flag burning stuff. That's not our issue, but there are real things here that are going to affect whether or not you're going to be able to pay your mortgage next month.
We have to have the same kind of issues that get emotional responses from workers as some of the issues that you described get emotional response from other voters. We have to make sure that workers understand what those issues are. And we have to unmask what basically is going on. When they use those kind of wedge issues, it's not based on what their true feelings about abortion are. It's based on what they're trying to do to the population in this country in terms of using those issues. The most effective thing we can do in terms of, as unions, we have to get back to those basic issues that our members understand. Issues about health care and the fact of what will happen in this country if current trends continue.
Yeah, and what will happen if current trends continue?
Well, you know, I often hear these assumptions made that somehow if it gets bad enough, somehow the federal government's going to step in. That's under the current administration, that's absolutely false. This current administration is gearing for the fact that fewer and fewer people in this country will have health care. There are not the finances available in this country as part of their budget to, in effect, invoke national health care. So clearly what their objective is to see a country where health care is available only to the most wealthy people in this country.
Yeah, Karl Rove has openly said that his idol is the guy who was McKinley's advisor, and that the McKinley administration is their model. McKinley, who lied us into the Spanish-American War in order to get himself reelected. McKinley, who opposed any kind of labor. I mean, back then they were murdering union members. This is the late 1890s. McKinley, who was hostile to labor policies, hostile to the people. And the average wage, the average working person in the United States in today's dollars during the McKinley administration was between $8,000 and $9,000 a year. We had there was virtually no middle class at that time, and that's what these guys are trying to take us back to. We've got to wake folks up to this. Let's take another phone call, and then we've got some folks in the studio. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia, with a question for Bob Potter of the UFCW. Hey, Steve, you're live with Bob.
Yeah, Bob. I worked in a factory, and I was actually a part of the management team there. I won't even say what industry it is or anything, but. They were very scared of a union coming into the factory, being voted in or allowed to enter the factory at all. And what they would do is the management would go around kind of threatening all the workers that, hey, if you get this union in here, we won't be able to financially operate, and we'll have to move to China. And so you better not vote this union in here. So they would repeat this message over and over and over. And have you ever heard of that going on anywhere else?
The answer to that is absolutely yes. And it's usually not just kind of threats, it's real threats. One of the factors that's real apparent under the current interpretation of the National Labor Relations Board is that employers have the right to say just about anything in the workplace. We have no access to employees in the workplace. And I've used this description before. If George Bush had to run for election, and the only thing he could do was to stand at the border of the U.S. and Canada and hand out leaflets, he wouldn't get his message across. That's the kind of position that unions are in. We can stand at the door of the workplace and hand out leaflets. We have no other means of direct contact with workers. Management is free to hold captive audience meetings, to hold coercive-type meetings, to also outright lie about what the effect of unionization will be. And that is not a violation of the law.
And not only are they free to do so, but they routinely do so.
They do so.
And how do you change that? I mean, wasn't there a time in the United States when that was against the law, when labor had access?
Never the kind of access that we truly needed, but clearly it was easier to get access 25 years ago than it is today.
Yeah, and so we need to be going back in that direction, in my opinion. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. We do have in the studio Tomas is with us. Hey, Tomas.
How you doing?
Good. You got to, you know, let's try that mic. There we go. Okay.
Yeah, 1-2-1-2.
Yeah.
This is your compassionate conservative cousin here.
Okay.
I have a question for labor. When the Mexican truck issue came up, how was that resolved? How did labor deal with that? Because I know NAFTA was going to let all those Mexican trucks in, and how are the truckers in America competing with that type of low-cost competition?
That issue has not been fully resolved. It's still a real issue. It's still an issue in terms of what kind of competition occurs under NAFTA. Specific to the question that you asked, the threat of what could happen in this country in terms of full deregulation of the trucking industry, allowing, in effect, competition to occur in the United States with the U.S. workforce in the context of even driving trucks is still a real issue. It is not resolved.
Yeah. Thank you, Tomas. The bottom line, though, is, Bob, it's not really competition. I mean, it's almost like we're using their language. They say, oh, we want to have competition in the workplace. Well, they want employees to compete against each other. In other words, they want the American workers to compete against Mexican workers who can come over the border legally as truck drivers, or against illegal aliens who are here, that sort of thing. But really, at the same time, the administration is working so hard to allow these mergers and acquisitions so that the big corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger, dominate larger and larger sectors of the marketplace, and then can be even more effective at holding labor at bay. Is that not true?
Well, and on top of that, Tom, they're competing. They want to structure a situation where workers are competing against workers within the United States itself.
Yeah.
Every organizing campaign that we're involved with, we see management pitting one worker against another. And that is prevalent throughout the United States. It's prevalent in our own debate about some of these issues. Issues about health care, for example, are often turned on their ear. in the sense of what it appears to be, what one worker gets, another worker doesn't get, where in reality it's about the universal aspect of health care and what should be available. So clearly it's to management's advantage to pit one worker against another. That's nothing new. It's been going on for a long time. It's probably more effective now because they can broaden their debate.
Yeah, well said. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. David has a question about unions. Hey, David, you're live with Bob Potter. Oh,
boy, do I have a bone to pick with you guys.
Okay.
First and foremost, I come from a family of immigrants, as do we all, who came over from the Middle East and didn't know a word of English, did well, put each other through school, and most of them became entrepreneurs. At what point do you say, hey, you know what? Nobody owes me a job. Nobody owes me health care. It would be ideal, but you know what? These entrepreneurs, and Thomas, you grew up here. Look what Van Andel and DeVos have done for the local community. How many people rely on them for employment? Why is it up to these people to supply health care when the general public in general, it's not guaranteed in the Constitution? It would be nice, but who are you to tell an employer what to dictate to pay you? If you're unhappy, you can go elsewhere, open your own business, yeah, and then let your employees dictate the terms of work to you.
Or go to Mexico. Bob?
Oh, well, you know what? It's a free country. We are free to choose where we're happy. Tom, I don't understand the socialist attitude. And it just makes no sense. Why would you degrade somebody? How many people locally rely on Van Andel and DeVos for employment? A ton.
Bob, you want to take a shot at that?
Yep. There are a number of issues that you raised, but let me just speak very specifically about immigrant workers and immigrant worker rights. There's only one organization that has addressed that issue effectively, and that's labor unions. Labor unions have, in effect, advocated rights for workers who are immigrants. And clearly, the advancement of immigrants in this country, my grandparents were immigrants to this country. Who has advanced the rights of immigrants in this country besides the labor movement? When immigrants came into this country, in effect, there was opportunity for them to have economic growth under very limited circumstances. Where they had the ability to advance, in effect, was provided by institutions like organized labor, who were proponents for worker rights regardless of the person's national origin. So clearly, in effect, immigration, rights of immigrant workers, is an issue that's a vital one to labor. It is not a vital one to corporations like Amway in this country.
And in fact, if you go back, also my grandfather came over here from Norway in 1917. I mean, I have an immigrant family. My mother's family came over many, many years before that. But in any case, if you look at the history of the United States in the 19th century in particular, before there was a labor movement, what you saw was massive exploitation of labor. In fact, there was indenturing of labor. In New England, where I used to live up in Vermont, some at one point as much as a quarter of the population, and these were of Europeans, right, people from European ancestry, were living in indentures of between 7 and 15 years, 7 and 15 years of slave labor, essentially. And in many cases, it actually was. It was not that different than slave labor in the South. And that's the world that they want to take us back to. Oh, you want to have a job here? Sign this piece of paper that says we own you for the next 7 years.
Tom, I want to really echo that point in the context of what we have to do in the here and now. Clearly, one of the things that labor has to address is the fact that we're a voice for workers. And often what that means is that we're also a voice for the disenfranchised in this country. And the most disenfranchised people in this country, we want them to turn to labor to have an effective voice in this country. So part of this is about empowerment. And we see ourselves, the labor movement in this country, as a way to empower people, empower workers to give them a voice, to give them economic access to this country.
Well said. Laura in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Laura.
Hi. So I'm confused. I've been a lifelong Democrat. I'm in my 50s. I'm recently married to a man who's a Republican, and we have many arguments, one of which is about unions. I understand historically the development of unions. What he professes to me is that, for example, the General Motors situation now is a result of unions asking too much of the company and, you know, it bankrupting it itself. He used to be a car dealer. He talks about how, you know, the unions make it impossible for, in the service department, for example, for...
Laura, let me just jump in here for a minute.
Okay,
You know, his point is that's the basic conservative talking point, but the reality is that our international trade policies are what is causing union employees in the United States, or any employee in the United States who's getting a decent wage, to suddenly have to compete against employees in other countries who are making $3, $4, $5 an hour. It is not unions. It's not even American workers, although the cons would love to blame them. It is the international trade policies and labor policies in this country that are being promulgated by conservatives, and then they blame us. So, Bob, we'll let you wrap up on that as soon as we come back. The music means we've got to go to a break. But, Laura, thanks for the call. You raise an important and a really important point. And the conservative talking points on this is so consistent and, unfortunately, so wrong. Or fortunately, I guess. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the live chat room. We're talking with Bob Potter. Bob is president of Local 951 of UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers. And Bob, just in a quick summary, what's UFCW up to?
Put us in this context, Tom. We're moving forward. We're moving forward as a local union. We're moving forward as an international union. Recently, in the state of Michigan, 40,000 home health care workers organized with SEIU. We think that same kind of organizing activity can happen in the retail industry. That's what we're specifically interested in. We think there's the opportunity for workers to become empowered, to empower themselves. In this climate, especially here in Michigan, we're looking forward to having some broad-based organizing activities in retail, very specific to some parts of the industry. For example, we think that the drugstore industry in Michigan is one that can be organized and should be organized. We know the workers there are interested in organizing. We believe that's an area where we can have an effective program, and part of that effective program will come about through the coalition that was just formed with four other international unions, where all five of those unions are interested in the kind of an approach in the service industry that caused the recent organization of those 40,000 home health care workers in Michigan. We want to come back by the beginning of next year and say, guess what? We think that was such an effective strategy that now we can talk about another 40,000 workers in the retail industry in Michigan. That's what we're about. Part of that also has to be, what kinds of issues do workers want us to address? Where do they want to become empowered? Well, we know one that's very effective, and that's on the issue of health care. This isn't about taking benefits away from one worker, giving them to another. This is about empowering workers to have access to the health care system in this country. That's what we're trying to do, is to ensure the fact that workers, regardless of what industry they work in, have access to power in this economy.
And specifically, what can people do to support this? In fact, Bob, you know, we've got, I still have a bunch of callers for you. Can you stick around for another 10 minutes or so into the first segment of our next hour? I'd like to do that, because we're out of time here. And I really want to get into it. Like, what, for example, what is card check? We haven't mentioned card check at all today. I don't think most people know about some of the battles that are going on just to make it possible for people to have representation in the workplace. And you know, to our earlier caller who was saying, hey, you know, let's just go back to the days when there's no unions, Do you want to have any kind of a floor at all? Do you want to have any sort of, you know, any sort of standard of living, any sort of middle class? The only thing, I'm telling you, the only thing that's standing between the American worker and the complete loss of the American middle class is organized labor in the United States. That's it. And if we don't get smart about this, we're going to be in big trouble. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, toll free nationwide. We're with Bob Potter, the president of the UFCW in Local 951 in Michigan, international vice president of the UFCW. And just a few quick calls, Bob. I appreciate your hanging over. It's not usual that we ask a guest to do this, but you've really stirred things up here. So let's get to the phone lines. Larry in Michigan on the line. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Potter.
Good afternoon.
Hi, I just want to say my wife works at local Myers here in Grand Rapids area, and so she's a member of the union, and I just wanted to put a human face. This guy earlier was saying, why doesn't everybody go be an entrepreneur? Well, who would wait on people at the Myers or, you know, wherever? The second thing, he was complaining about health care. And when you look at a company like Walmart, who throws their people on the public rolls to get help, well, let me put a human face on this. Having recently been diagnosed with cancer and the fact that my wife has the health coverage for this family, beginning to look at what whatever treatment method I choose, what it would cost, and looking at the impact on people who don't have insurance, I think that's a pretty strong case of what unions are about. It's not just the wages.
Yeah, and the point being, because Myers is unionized, and if somebody's working at Walmart, they might be out of luck.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Bob, you want to speak to that?
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks for the endorsement and the human face on this. One further comment about the caller's question, and that would be in regards to the fact that every entrepreneur out there has the right to join an organization that advances their causes. Chamber of Commerce and any other number of organizations, they can get together collectively and act collectively.
And they do.
And
by
they
the way.
Do.
You know, my small business, which is this radio show, when we were in Vermont, we were a member of the Chamber of Commerce. We were a member of a union for entrepreneurs, for small businesses.
We believe workers should have that same right.
Yeah, it's really simple. It's not rocket science. And in fact, the Chamber of Commerce, interestingly, in Vermont, the small local Chamber of Commerce was actually doing a lot of things for small businesses that were in the interest of small businesses. Increasingly, though, what I'm seeing across the United States is that a lot of entrepreneurs are really upset with Chambers of Commerce and other business organizations that say that they're there for the small entrepreneurs but have been taken over by big multinationals. And what they're really all about is destroying the small businesses, just like the average workers. I mean, it's like the entrepreneurs increasingly are discovering that they're in the same boat as the American workers, that were being eaten alive by the robber barons.
They're actually finding out that they're not Republicans anymore.
Yes, there you go. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Lee in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Lee.
Good afternoon, Tom, and your guest.
Bob.
I really wanted to comment on this whole Republican situation with this Bush administration, and it ties in with labor also, because I'm concerned about, you know, this association they have with China. They're getting closer with China and then sending jobs over to different countries and then just basically just putting the screws to the workers. Okay, now I'm a strong believer in unions. We do need unions. Okay, and I think it's like a little fine balance. Some companies may not want to be unionized, but we do need unions, period, you know, in this country, because someone has to speak up for the common person. And I just want to thank you guys for your show. We get it out of Akron on
Radio Free Ohio.
Radio Free Ohio. They
there
don't
you
even
go.
They don't even want to use their call letters because it begins with W.
There you go.
But, you know, I just like the fact that somebody's standing up to what I call this Bush administration juggernaut.
Yeah.
And if you don't, it's going to run right over everybody, you know.
There you
and
go.
I have problems with the illegal aliens, 9 million plus in America working jobs. The Republicans would have you think that, well, those are jobs that don't nobody want. But the fact is, the key word in that is the illegal. You know what I'm saying? Some of those jobs.
Yeah, the reality here, Lee, is that there is no job. There is no job that an American wouldn't do. I mean, I remember as a kid watching the Jackie Gleason show. Jackie Gleason's buddy, Art Carney, worked in the sewers in New York. Mm-hmm. They used to make jokes about him coming home, you know, with the sewer smell on his shoes. There is no job that an American won't do for a decent wage.
That's right.
That's really what it's all about is, you know, the decent wages are gone, and then you get, you know, all these illegal immigrants. And, of course, the Bush administration loves this, you know, and now we're providing 10% of the gross domestic product for this country of Mexico by illegal immigrants sending back paychecks to Mexico. I mean, this is a scary situation.
It is.
Lee, thanks for the call. You wanted to make another point?
Well, I want to say is as far as your guest, I can't remember his name, but he
Bob Potter.
Okay, Bob, he mentioned getting a worker as much information as possible. Follow the money trail. I've been discovering all kinds of things, so that's my advice.
Okay,
follow the money trail.
Lee, thanks a lot, and thanks for listening to us there on Radio Free Ohio. Bob, your take on Lee's comments about China and about the Bush administration. I'm curious, to what extent can unions get politically active?
First of all, we want voters to be free in Ohio, and we want workers to be free in Ohio, as well as radio to be free in Ohio.
Well said.
Clearly, the place for us to start, if I'm a worker in the United States, if I'm a worker in Michigan, the place to start tomorrow is to contact a union. We can provide a forum for workers to act collectively.
Even if they're not unionized.
Even if they're not
in a place, in a workplace that will ever have a union. You can still call up a union and have a conversation with somebody and get some useful information.
Absolutely. And not picking one union over another. Clearly, depending on the industry they work in, they can pick a union that's active in that industry. But that's the place to start. We want them to be active politically. And very frankly, part of what this coalition is trying to do is broaden what our political actions are. We need to broaden how we act politically. We need to be involved in the communities in which our members work. But the place to start is to get workers a voice and have them contact us, and that's the most effective thing that they can do for us.
Step one. And how do they most effectively contact you?
Every one of us have a web page. We have telephone numbers in the yellow pages.
Look under unions in the yellow pages.
Look under labor unions in the yellow pages. Good place to start.
Oh, is it under L or under U?
It's under labor unions.
Under L. Okay,
yes.
Great. In the yellow pages. Vicki in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the phone. Hey, Vicki, you're live with Bob Potter.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Now, I have a couple of things in response to the gentleman who called espousing the entrepreneurial spirit, big business in DeVos and Van Andel. First of all, ideally, employers should strive to compensate people well in order to retain the best and the brightest. I mean, to me, it's that simple. And secondly, I realize healthcare is a huge burden on employers, and I'm also a huge proponent of a national healthcare program. However, since we don't have one, it seems to me that employers should offer the best healthcare programs available to keep the workers healthy and working, because it's in the best interest of productivity. I don't, you know, get this greedy winner-take-all thing. You know, I'm wondering, whatever happened to the values of social responsibility?
Well, yeah, you know, they'll say it's best for worker productivity, but in a nation where you have increasingly large numbers of desperate workers and or illegals willing to take jobs, they don't care. They can just recycle people. Really, ultimately, what this gets down to, Bob, doesn't it, is the question that really was a legitimate matter for debate in the United States from the 1880s through the 1930s, and even into the 1950s it was being discussed. The whole furor around Taft-Hartley in 1947 was being discussed about whether there is a social contract of importance, whether that between employers and we the people through government, whether businesses here to, number one, make a profit, certainly. God bless them. It's, you know, we're all in favor of the American way, and none of us want the government making our shoes. None of us are in favor of, you know, socialism, USSR, whatever. But on the one hand, making profit, but on the other hand, doing so in a way that helps society forward itself, that any institution that government authorizes, and government authorizes corporations. If you want to create a corporation, you have to go to the Secretary of State and register. Any agency that government authorizes has to fulfill some positive social function at the same time that it's making money. Is that not an issue?
There is a social contract in this country. There certainly is a social contract in this country between government and its citizens, between various institutions and their members. And one of those institutions, a mediating institution, if you will, in this country, are labor unions. For labor unions to move forward, we have to make sure workers demand the rights that they have under the social contract in this country.
Okay, great. Tom is on the line. Tom, I'm not seeing the city on our screening software here. What city are you in?
I'm in Grand Rapids.
Oh, okay, great. Hey, Tom. You're live with Bob Potter.
Hi, Tom and Bob. How you doing?
Good afternoon.
Good. I just wanted to ask you a question, Bob. I've been watching all the brouhaha about the casino going in Gun Lake, and I'm a vendor, and I stopped in to listen to what they had to say, and they said they want to make that at all a union project. Are you guys supporting that?
This is the construction of that project? Is that the question? Or the people who work there?
Tom? Tom is gone. Tom hung up. So... I guess, you know, we don't know. I don't know. Do you know about that, Bob?
I'd comment, in fact, in terms of both. We think that the construction should be union, and we think that the people who work there should be union.
Yeah, well, that's pretty straightforward and pretty simple. So the way, now, ultimately, we've got about a minute and a half here in this segment, maybe 2 minutes just to wrap this up. To go from the macro to the micro, what can individuals who are listening right now, you suggested they can contact their local union. The AFL-CIO has some sort of an outreach program, do they not?
They do. They do. You know, part of the difficulty in the context of the question that you asked is how do we break that to very specifically what can they do in Grand Rapids tomorrow?
Right.
And that's
Or in Missoula, or in Cleveland, or in Youngstown, Ohio.
Right. What do they do tomorrow? And we think the most effective way for them to reach out to labor is to contact, not through a broad-based organization, but contact a local union in their area. There are an untold number of local unions that have effective programs. That's the place to start. We think it can be generated. We can generate a lot more positive activity by starting it at that level. It's fine they contact the AFL on the webpage. It's fine they contact us through our Walmart webpage, but in reality, we want them to begin at the local level, and that place is the local union.
What is your Walmart webpage?
WalmartWatch.com.
WalmartWatch.com. And now, there was, you guys were spearheading an effort out in California that was in the middle of a lot of controversy. What happened with that? What came out with that? And how do you see that translating into national efforts?
If you the question really is in terms of legislation that affects the size of a store that's built and where they can be built. Again, I think that kind of an approach should be left up to the local community. In California, what we saw very effectively is this. Legislation was passed in Los Angeles that restricted the size of a store that could be built within a certain county area. Walmart turned right around and changed the configuration of the store, brought it within the guidelines of what the new law was. But we think those are issues that, again, the local population has to decide on their approach.
Yeah, because you guys are in favor of democracy. Us guys.
Us guys.
I'm a member of the labor union as well. I'm a member of AFTRA. Us guys are in favor of democracy as well. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Bob Potter's been with us. Thanks so much, Bob. 20 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We were born before the wind. Oh, so young.
And welcome back, my friends. As we sail into the mystic.
Well, the bonnie boat was one. as we sail into the mystic.
24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRM Digital. Welcome back to our program. There was an interesting, really interesting event here in Michigan that really gave George W. Bush an uncomfortable moment, shall we say. Chad, minimally, shall we say, an uncomfortable moment?
I'd say so, Tom. It was, I think the president and Karl Rove and his operatives kind of showed up with one plan and some really great Christians of conscience at Calvin College and a lot of other supporting people around the Grand Rapids area in western Michigan really threw him for a loop.
Yeah. Chad, first, why don't you introduce yourself, what you're doing with this?
My name's Chad. I'm a member of a group called Neo Pros, and
Neo Pros?
Neo Pros.
Like Neo Professionals?
Well, Neo Pros, kind of like pros like poetry. We focus on the words of democracy, basically.
Neo Pros.
Yeah, and we're very concerned about the convergence of church, state, defense and business, and when two of those things go together, that's where we try to do our work. We do have a little bit of a blog, but most of the work we do is really kind of behind the scenes and just pointing things out to people. And
yeah.
we did a little bit of support for the Air Force Academy story, which is pretty big now.
You're talking about the proselytizing of people,
yeah,
within
absolutely.
The Air Force.
Actually, one of our members had a contact who actually had some internal documents there at the Air Force Academy. And,
you mean this is institutional? This goes beyond just overzealous chaplains?
Well, they've had a lot of issues there with the Christian Union and that kind of thing. Actually, Dobson and the Christian Union, which is a college evangelical group, has actually had events at the Air Force Academy.
Right.
And some of these documents, actually a study that was being, it looked like it was a study that was focused, was going to be given over to a faith-based operation to do a study of the, quote, spiritual environment.
Right.
And the ability of Air Force cadets to face the,
well, you know, Bush passed out
choices.
$1 billion last year to faith-based organizations. You got to work pretty hard to give away $1 billion.
Well,
so pretty marginal groups are probably getting. I know Reverend Moon is getting a lot of that money, but probably a lot of fairly marginal groups are getting
right.
It.
Right. Well, I'm a Service Academy graduate, and we have several Service Academy graduates working on our team, and the Service Academies are not a place for this religious war that's going on.
Yeah.
It's just not the right place for it.
Absolutely. So, Calvin College, we had about a minute and a half here left. Calvin College, what happened?
Well, what happened at Calvin College...
First of all, Calvin College is historically...
Calvin College is a reformed private school. There are actually two in the area. There's Hope College and Calvin College. And they're a Christian Reformed church. They also have a seminary there,
which is a very conservative church.
It's a conservative church, but Calvin's also been a place where there's been a lot of dialogue about various issues. They're big on poverty. They wrote the president a letter, along with a lot of other denominations, calling for the president to do something about world poverty, and that's really a big issue with the students there.
This is what Jesus talked about.
That's right. And I think what happened was that Bush spoke on Saturday, and Tuesday afternoon there were like 304 people that said, hey, let's put an ad in the paper in the Grand Rapids Press and write a letter to the president. And 48 hours later, they had 823 people on this list and put a full-page ad in the Grand Rapids Press.
This is out of a couple thousand people at the college.
Right. Well, they have 54,000 graduates in total, but there are 900 graduates in each class.
Right.
And I think some of the Colson and his crowd are trying to, well, first of all, belittle what happened in Calvin, and also kind of paint them. Actually, the Washington Times preempted the event on the 17th. The speech was on the 21st, saying that, well, they've lost the scripture. See,
the Washington Times, Reverend Moon's newspaper.
Right, exactly, yeah. Reverend Moon. And it's just amazing how these people, they really did it in a classy, unbelievable way. And then hundreds of people, the AP reported a couple dozen, there were hundreds of people. Where I was standing, it was about 400. And we figured there was somewhere between 600 to 700 people out there that day.
Who were doing what?
Who were holding up signs like, blessed are the rich. And you have a Christian Reformed church housewife on one end of the sign and a Unitarian psychologist on the other. It was just an amazing event, Tom.
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. At Calvin College. Chad, good work. Good on you. Keep it up. It's marvelous to see these sort of things going on. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 33 minutes past the hour, 27 before, however you like to count it. We're broadcasting live from the Celebration Cinema in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG's studio away from home, studio away from studio. In the studio with me is Dave from Grand Rapids. And Dave, you had an interesting story to tell about something that's going on in the Philippines. I thought this was fascinating. I wanted to share it with my listeners.
Yes, I just found out my wife is a Filipino. Mm-hmm. And currently she had to go back there. Excuse me. They do have an Asian television show here on cable. And with this Asian television show, I found out that there's something going on with the Philippine government, and they call it Gloria Gate.
Gloria
Arroyo is the president of the Philippines.
Yeah.
Turns out she was caught on tape fixing the election for the Philippines.
For herself?
For herself.
Yeah.
And
was she doing it with voting machines? I don't think they use voting machines there, do they?
No, it's still paper. Yeah, it was still paper
so
at that point.
Stuffing ballot boxes.
They weren't stuffing them. They weren't reporting the correct numbers.
Ah. Okay.
And they have this on tape. It was sent to a couple different people where they actually had looked at it and put it on the computer to match it to her voice. It's a perfect match.
Oh,
and what they want to do is they want to have her either confirm or deny. And what she's doing is she's staying tight-lipped about the whole thing.
So the bottom line here now, because the story gets even weirder mm-hmm. in just a moment. But the bottom line is there's a furor going on in the Philippines. I've been in the Philippines, and people are very involved in politics in the Philippines, or at least they were when I was there. Last time I was there was the week Ferdy Marcos got thrown out.
Yes.
And the demonstrations going past my hotel where they were carrying the coffin of the guy who got shot up in his Jeep, and you know who, and the whole bit. In fact, for 5 days I couldn't leave the country because every single I was on Philippine Airlines. I was holding a confirmed ticket, yes. And every day I got bumped because all of Ferdy's buddies were flying to Hawaii, you know. And so anyhow, it's a long story, but. Very, very politically aware citizenry. And so there is Gloria Gate going on, fixing of elections, and then on national television in the Philippines,
yes.
A story which no American media will touch.
Here's what was said by one of the people there that they were interviewing. They had said...
You saw this.
Yes, I watched this on one of the local cable stations here.
Yeah.
And what was said is... They went to a person that was on the street, and they said, why wouldn't Gloria fix this election? They did it in America.
So the rest of the world is looking at us going, well, they feel like they fix elections. Why can't we?
Exactly.
And I guarantee you that there are countries around the world going, well, they torture people. Why can't we?
Yes, and I would like to remind, too, that the Philippines is probably one of our closest allies.
Yeah.
And these are the people that are looking at us, and they're seeing America as a great place to be, and this is what they're seeing us as now.
Yeah, pretty amazing, pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. David, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you for allowing me, Tom.
I appreciate it. Thanks for coming by. Kristen Breitweiser has responded to Karl Rove. Karl Rove, you'll note yesterday or the day before, had this nice little comment about how liberals just saw the horror of 9/11 and wanted to offer therapy to terrorists. First of all, I'm not sure what liberal he's talking about. I don't know of any who want to offer therapy to therapists or to terrorists. And in fact, to the best of my knowledge, all the liberals, progressives, Democrats, everybody else has been out there saying, why don't we track these people down and bring them to justice? I mean, they're criminals, they're wackos, they're terrorists. They've committed a horrible crime. They should be in prison. But anyhow, Karl Rove. And so Christian Breitweiser, whose son died in Iraq. She says, Mr. Rove, the first thing I'd like to address is Afghanistan, the place that anybody with a true understanding of 9/11 knows is the nation that actually has a connection to the 9/11 attacks. 1 month after 9/11, we invaded Afghanistan, took down the Taliban, and then left without capturing Osama bin Laden, the alleged perpetrator of the September 11 attacks. In the meantime, Afghanistan has carried out democratic elections, but continues to suffer from extreme violence and unrest. Poppy production. Yes, Carl, the drug trade, writes Kristen Breitweiser, is at an all-time high, thus flooding the world market with heroin. And, of course, the oil pipeline, also known as the Caspian Sea Pipeline, is better protected by U.S. troops who now have a legitimate excuse to be in that part of Afghanistan. Interesting, isn't it, Carl, that the drug rat line parallels the oil pipeline. Yes, with all those troops guarding the same sliver of land, can you please explain how those drugs keep getting through, Mr. Rove? She says, more to the point, Karl Rove, when you say conservatives saw the savage of the 9/11 attacks and prepared for war, how exactly did you prepare for your war? Did your preparations include sound intelligence to warrant your actions? A reasonable entry and exit strategy coupled with a coherent plan to carry out that strategy? The proper training and equipment for the troops you were sending in to fight your war? Did you follow the advice of experts such as General Shinseki, who correctly advised you about the troop levels needed to actually succeed in Iraq? No, you didn't. The reality is, and then end of quote from Kristen Breitweiser, the reality is conservatives saw the savagery of the 9/11 attacks and prepared to invade a country that had nothing to do with it! Nothing whatsoever! Why? Because, they wanted to take back the Senate. They wanted to have a war. George W. Bush wanted to be a war president. He'd always wanted to be a war president. He didn't want to be a war enlistee. He didn't want to be a war pilot. He didn't want to go to war with the Texas Air National Guard, but he certainly wanted to be a war president. Kristen Breitweiser says that it has always been America's policy that you only place soldiers' lives in harm's way when it's absolutely necessary and the absolute last resort. When you send troops into combat, you support those troops by providing them with proper equipment and training. Why, Karl Rove, didn't you do that with the troops you sent into Iraq? This by Kristen Breitweiser, the mother of a woman, of a young man who died in Iraq. Why wasn't her son? Why weren't their vehicles armored? To this day, they're not. Why didn't they have protective vests? Why weren't they properly trained about the rules of interrogation? And Carl, when our troops came home, be it tragically in body bags or with missing limbs, you should honor and acknowledge their service to their country. You shouldn't hide them by bringing them home in the dark of night, says Kristen Breitweiser, the mother of a young man who died in Iraq. Most importantly, she says, you should take care of them for the long haul by giving them substantial veterans benefits and care. For me, that's being truly patriotic. For me, that's how you support your troops. To me, that's how you show you know the value of a human life given for its country. For the record, Carl, does Iraq have any connection to the 9/11 attacks? Because you and your friends, with your collective understanding of 9/11, seem to be contradicting yourselves about the Iraq 9/11 connection, too. First, we were told we went to war with Iraq because it was linked to the 9/11 attacks. Then your rationale was changed to Iraq has WMD when we discovered there was no connection to 9/11. Then when we discovered there was no WMD, you told us we needed to invade because Saddam was a bad man. And now it turns out we didn't invade because Saddam was a bad man. We invaded to bring democracy to Iraq. She says, Carl, you say you understand 9/11. Then why did you and your friends so vehemently oppose the creation of a 9/11 independent commission? Once the commission was established, why did you refuse to properly fund the commission by allotting it only a $3 million budget? Why did you refuse to allow access to documents and witnesses for the 9/11 commissioners? Why did we have to fight so hard for an extension when the commissioners told us they needed more time due to your foot-dragging and stonewalling? Why didn't you want to cooperate so all Americans could understand what happened on 9/11, Mr. Rove? Kristen Breitweiser, to date you have done practically nothing to secure our ports, our nuclear power plants, our mass transportation systems. Imagine if the billions of dollars you spent in Iraq were more wisely spent on those things here at home. Imagine what sort of alternative energy resources, biodiesel, wind power, solar power, hybrid automobiles, could have been researched and funded in the last 3 years. Talk about regaining the respect and support of the world. That's a way to do it. Carl, if you understand 9/11, then why don't you understand that until we have a more environmentally friendly energy policy, we cannot effectively fight the war on terrorism? By being dependent on foreign oil, we have no choice but to cozy up to nations who sponsor terrorists. Moreover, because of oil, we may end up placing our troops in our nations at greater risk by having to invade certain oil-rich countries. And our invasion of those countries merely serves to inflame would-be terrorists by reinforcing their notion that we are gluttonous and self-centered. Invading nations, sovereign nations, solely to steal their oil? Forgive me, Carl, but is that how you think you win hearts and minds? Is that how you think you spread democracy? Finally, Carl, Kristen Breitweiser writes, the mother of a young man who died in Iraq. She says, finally, Carl, talking to Karl Rove, the guy who the other day said that liberals saw the horrors of 9/11 and only wanted to offer therapy to terrorists. She says, finally, Carl, and the conservatives understood the horrors of 9/11. Yes. She says, finally, Carl, if you understand that the reason we have not suffered a repeat attack on our homeland is because Osama bin Laden no longer needs to attack us. Those of us with a pure and comprehensive understanding of 9/11 know that bin Laden committed the 9/11 attacks so he could increase recruitment for Al-Qaeda and increase worldwide hatred of America. This didn't happen immediately after 9/11 because the world united with Americans and Al-Qaeda's recruitment levels didn't increase. It was only after your invasion of Iraq, Carl, that bin Laden's goals were met. Because of your war in Iraq, two things happened that helped bin Laden and the terrorists. Al-Qaeda recruitment soared, and the United States is now alienated from and hated by the rest of the world. In effect, what bin Laden could not achieve by murdering my husband and 3,000 others on 9/11, you handed to him on a silver platter with your invasion of Iraq, a country that has nothing to do with 9/11. Excuse me, Kristen Breitweiser, I was mixing her up with somebody else. Her husband died in the World Trade Center. She says, and she wraps it up by finally saying, which leads me to my final question for you, Carl. What are your motives when it comes to 9/11? And are you really sure that you understand 9/11? Somehow I think not. Somehow I think very much not. Our number 1-866-889-8894. We'll get your calls in just a second. Pat is in the studio with us here in Grand Rapids. We've invited the folks who've come down to Celebration Cinema to come in and say hi. And if there's something on their mind, that we'll put them in front of a microphone. So it's the same thing as calling in, except you get to be here right in the studio. Hey, Pat.
Hi.
Hi. What's up?
Thank you for what you do. We really, my family and I, we really love the show.
Thank you.
And we learn a lot. I've got a couple things, two issues that are sort of related. The Dick Durbin issue last week where the real issue got lost of the way we treat our criminals in Guantanamo and how one reason we don't want to be too mean to those people is so our soldiers don't get treated.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, first of all, they're alleged criminals because they've never had a trial. In fact, we're discovering that because we were paying a bounty when we were in Afghanistan, we were saying to the locals, hey, if you bring in a terrorist, we'll give you $500. So people who had a grudge match, who were PO'd with their next-door neighbor, were saying, oh, hey, Ralph, over here, or Ahmed, you know, he's a terrorist. And we'd snatch him, and we'd pay the $500. And we've got people down in Guantanamo. We know. I mean, you know, this is acknowledged by the Defense Department. We got taxi drivers. We got people who had nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever. They just happened to have somebody who hated them enough to turn them in for $500.
Oh, and they're being abused, and so our soldiers are going to be abused the same way. We have no separation from the Nazis, for instance. And so the real issue, got lost. Instead, the issue became Dick Durbin called our soldiers Nazis, and so the whole
which he didn't.
No, he didn't.
Yeah.
And so anyway, related to that, I heard a interview yesterday with Christopher Whitcomb, who's a really bright terrorism expert. And he was saying, talking about Guantanamo specifically and closing it, and he said the real issue there is not what to do with these criminals. It's that we have 400 to 500 hardened hating Americans there, and what do we do with them?
We created that. It's not that different in a way, I suppose, from the dawning realization that's happening to America that when you arrest nonviolent criminals for drug offenses, which are principally really medical problems, and you put them in a maximum security prison, they might not have been hardened criminals when they went in. But they definitely are going to be when they come out. Mm-hmm. And we're doing great violence to our own society with our crazy drug laws. And similarly, we're doing violence to ourselves and to the world by the way that, you know, the lawless way mm-hmm. that the Bush administration, Alberto Gonzalez with his memos and things, the lawless way that we're treating these people.
So my concern is that, you know, the real issues are getting lost because the Republicans don't want to
change the subject.
Yeah, they don't want us to be focused on the real issue.
Yeah, they just want to change the subject as fast as they can. Pat, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Great to have you here. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Alan in Trumansburg, New York on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Alan?
I read your piece on your website, tomhartman.com, titled When Democracy Failed.
Yes, sir.
And it's excellent, and I would encourage everybody to read it, especially now with the Dick Durbin controversy.
It's also a chapter in both my book, We the People, and What Would Jefferson Do, just to give a shameless plug. So, your question.
It's an objective look at the similarities between pre-war Germany and now. And I don't understand why people are shying away from learning from our past. It seems to me that if it's inappropriate or rude to draw comparisons between what we have now and what we had then, especially with evidence from the FBI of torture, then when is it going to be appropriate? When it's too late?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people now who are suggesting we're awful close to it's too late, because although they aren't using all of the police powers that they're claiming yet, the government has been increasingly claiming police powers and engaging in behaviors that historically would have been considered bizarre. I mean, before Bush came along, can you imagine if during the Kennedy-Nixon debates or Eisenhower or LBJ, I mean, LBJ had to put up with all those protests. If they said, okay, the president's going to come and speak, but if anybody wants to protest, they have to go to a wire cage a mile away. We're calling it a free speech zone. I am just astounded to this day that Americans have not, stood up in revolt against just that. Just that one thing, that absolute, spitting in the face of the First Amendment. Alan, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate you raise an important issue. This administration, not committed to democracy. They are using democracy as a buzzword to sell corporatism around the world, and it's harming us. It's harming the United States of America. It's 10 minutes before the hour on the Tom Harpin program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, it's coming, my friends.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from sirens night and day. From the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming
to the USA. There you go. Democracy is, if enough of us get active, if enough of us stand up and say, no, we're not going to put up with laws that take away our rights. We're not going to put up with elected officials who say that if we want to exercise our First Amendment right to assemble peaceably and petition the government for redress of grievance, that we have to be put at the barrel of a gun inside a barbed wire fence. If enough of us stand up and say no, then we can take democracy back and say yes to democracy. Say yes to to a clear and progressive agenda. By the way, just a few quick things I just have to share with you. We were talking earlier about Walmart, and just in general, the WalmartFacts.com, great website. Great website. A website set up by Walmart, right? If you read this website, WalmartFacts.com, you'll discover that they had $285 billion in sales last year. They oppose strengthening child labor laws in Connecticut and hide the cover of Marie Claire magazine with a sheet of plastic. One statistic you won't find, however, how many of their employees are forced to enroll in Medicaid for health coverage. This is from the Center for American Progress. Inquiring minds want to know. Yesterday, said Senators Ted Kennedy and John Corzine and Congressman Anthony Weiner introduced the Health Care Accountability Act, which would require states to report annually the number of workers relying on taxpayer-funded health programs. Workers. Walmart does not want this to happen. Kennedy and the bill's sponsors estimate that 600,000 of Walmart's 1.3 million workers do not have company insurance. As a result, he says, every worker in America is paying in part a part of their taxes for Walmart. This is not going to stop them. It's just going to point it out. Now, for the latest on this, go to WalmartWatch.com, by the way. WalmartWatch.com is the site to really check out. But the corporate PR department, as they noted, Center for American Progress, at Walmart really doesn't think this is a big deal. Corporate PR department, what's the big hubbub? Company spokesman Nate Hurst said some uninsured Walmart workers, quote, may turn to state Medicaid programs, which were designed to provide medical insurance at very low cost to relatively low-income residents at better premiums and related costs than even Walmart can negotiate. End of quote. You don't like our insurance, our so-called insurance. Go get state Medicaid. It'll be easy, no problem, and the taxpayers pay for it. Yeah, and it's not about low prices, by the way. It's about profits for the Walton family. Pure and simple. 1/9 of the profits of the Walton family. Every Walmart worker could have good pay. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.